Hello and welcome to The Savage Beast. My name is Dan White, aka The Beast Must Die, and I am here as always with my co-host Matt Colgate, aka Lord Nuneaton Savage.
Hello there.
And this time around, for our first show of 2021, we're going to have a look at family films. Yes. So not family friendly films, not at all, in fact.
Actually, no, but in no cases.
No, but films about families or with families as a kind of central theme. Whenever that is kind of set up in a film as a theme or as a framework, it almost always doesn't go well. You rarely get a film about a family all having a great time together, it has to be said. So
yeah. It's a funny one, isn't it? I was talking to the Duke Nuneaton Savage the other day, and he was complaining about particularly American films, like the amount of time that the message of the kind of the mainstream American film, it nearly always comes back to the idea of family, whoever they happen to be. Do you know what I mean? If you think of like all the Fast and the Furious movies, even the Marvel movies sort of come back to this idea of like family, the importance of the stable family unit and how it can get you through all of these sort of difficulties and trials. And at the end, you just sort of, if you all pull back and rely on it, you can overcome adversity. And like, I think pretty much all the films we've chosen are actually the opposite of that, that they're a hodgepodge of disgrace and fucked upness that ruin anybody that goes near them seems to be what we've gravitated towards, funnily enough.
Yeah, I guess they are somewhat united by the sort of inherent toxicity of a family. Not to say that there aren't positive things or more nuanced things than that. It's not simply like, you know, they fuck you up, your mum and dad. It's not that, but it is just that I think all of them have this feeling of like a slightly kind of claustrophobic entrapment that comes with being in a family.
Yes.
And how that lends itself to a variety of cinematic tones and sort of moods, really.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a subject that people will come back to time and time again in film because it's a great leveller, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, like nearly everyone has experiences of some kind or another, good or bad, with a family. So it's a way of appealing to as wide an audience as possible. It does seem a shame that on a mainstream level, the message, as I said, does seem to nearly always be pretty much the same when it comes to dealing with ideas of family, until you start moving into sort of genre fairs, like, you know, crime, horror and stuff like that. And then, you know, as you say, the toxicity of it sort of starts seeping out. But I do wonder, like, you know, what, because this idea of like the family being something that isn't inevitably a solid force and a good thing is actually a fairly modern one. That's not an idea that you see in centuries past, and I just sort of like wonder what the earliest film that dealt with a fucked up family was. You know what I mean? I wonder how far we have to go back before we find the first kind of fucked up family unit movie.
I always think like Hamlet. One of the reasons Hamlet is such a resonant text and is often taught in schools and lends itself to adaptation and. Because it really is just about a family, a fucked up family. And it's also about a kind of an adolescent, really, wrestling with his complicated feelings towards his parents and his sense of duty and all that stuff. It's a rich text, but it is interesting because it's very modern, Hamlet, and it's one of the reasons it does sort of bubble up more than the other ones, because it resonates. But I know what you mean. There was this kind of this idea of, within films, you know, you think back to, I don't know, the 40s and the 50s. And while there were film noirs and things like that, that were really, you know, and pre-code horrors that were dealing with sort of dark, fringy stuff. When you think of families, it is almost a sort of solid unit and a sense of stability that a film will have at its core and will sort of try and return to.
Yeah.
You know, it's... Divorce isn't a thing that you see in those films. Divided, atomized families isn't a thing. But also, I mean, even something like Rebel Without a Cause, you know, it's just about the general, that's a kind of film about teenagers. It's one of the first films saying, you know, there's a difference between the generations and he, you know, but the family unit is not, it's, you know, it's a schism there, but it's not that the parents are sort of presented as a unified front, really.
Yeah,
it's fascinating. I guess it goes along with a lot of things in the second half of the 20th century, the kind of explosion of a bunch of stuff that had been built up that was essentially phony anyway, and then just kind of imploded. So there's a period at which a lot of media sort of that we are familiar with starts to come into snap into focus sort of post-war. And that's the stuff that we grew up with as a background. And that is all about kind of breaking down of assumptions and certainties, as you head into the 60s and 70s. And now, I mean, I think if you see a film with a stable family unit, an actual family, then you're just waiting for it to go wrong. You're waiting for it to get creepy and weird.
Yes.
But as you say, the actual family framework is something like Boogie Nights is all about, hey, you find your family where you can. But as you say, so is the Fast and the Furious. And so is like, you know, it is like this really, you know, it's right up there with daddy issues as a really driving thing in a film. And it is actually, you know, really quite dull when you sort of see, oh, I see. They're essentially a family. They look after each other. And it's like, oh, here we go.
Well, it's like I say, it's that old cliche, isn't it? Where it's like, you know, like think about the amount of taglines that you could, the amount of times you could use. Under any film, you could use the tagline, it's about family, whoever they are. it's right up
there. Your family, yeah.
It's right up there with them. These two guys are going to learn a lot about themselves and each other. In terms of just like cliche taglines that you can just strap on pretty much any film.
We chose four films that... They're different in tone, and it was an interesting one because we've had like these episodes where it's been a bit dirgy or a bit kind of this was a real mixture, wasn't it? There's some real like swerves in the selection, but it definitely made me kind of come out going, yeah, I haven't seen my family for a while, and maybe that's okay.
Yes, it made the pill of separation quite a lot easier to swallow in some cases, definitely. Right, yeah. Should we start with our first film then?
Let's do it, yeah.
Okay, well, the first film we're going to be looking at is Hereditary from 2018.
Okay, so fine, then say what you want to say then.
Peter.
I don't want to say anything. I've tried saying
Okay,
things.
So try again, release yourself.
Oh, release you mean?
Yeah, fine, release me, just say it. Just fucking say it.
Don't you swear at me, you little shit. Don't you ever raise your voice at me. I am your mother. Do you understand? All I do is worry and slave and defend you. And all I get back is that fucking face on your face. So full of disdain and resentment and always so annoyed. Well, now your sister is dead. And I know you miss her. And I know it was an accident. And I know you're in pain. And I wish I could take that away for you. I wish I could shield you from the knowledge that you did what you did. But your sister is dead. She is gone forever.
Right. So, yeah, this was really interesting watching this again. This was my third time watching Hereditary. And I believe it was your second. So you should probably go first.
I saw Hereditary in the cinema. And I think it's important because that's quite a different experience to watching at home. And I very much felt that. The first watch was like a really intense and claustrophobic experience in a very dark cinema, sucked into this very, very claustrophobic and smothering filmic experience. And I came out of it feeling fairly brutalized and very impressed. You know, I was like, this is a really cracking good horror film, and this is someone I want to watch. But it took me a while. It took me doing this podcast to come around to watching it again, feeling I had to watch it again because I didn't want to watch it again. I realised I had a sort of like resistance to it. And so then to watch it this second time and notice the mechanics a bit more obviously and have a much more critical view of it, I would say, was an interesting experience. So how about you for the third time?
It's a fucking slog. at the risk of... You know, this is the thing, like people fucking love this film, and I'm not going to take it away from them. I think it's phenomenal achievement. I think it's one of the best horror, like we often use the term roller coaster as a negative, but I think in the best sense of the word, Hereditary is a roller coaster. you know, it picks you up and it just, you just go smash, 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 smash. It's a bloody miserable roller coaster. And the thing that I realized this time round, the second time round I watched it, I was a little bit pissed. Whereas this time round, I was a bit more complimented. The thing that I realized this time round is that I could just see the mechanics of it so much easier. And this film has the subtlety of a mallet. There's not an ounce of subtlety or letting the audience make its own mind up. It is just explaining and explaining and explaining, and it over explains, and it kind of killed it for me. So I came out of it the third time around, and I was like, I admire that film a great deal, but I don't think I'm ever going to love it. I don't think I'm ever going to love Hereditary. I think it's strange to see a film that's so atmospheric, because it is incredibly atmospheric. It's beautifully technically controlled, but so unsubtle. You know what I mean? It is just constantly using a, it's like someone hitting a banana with a hammer. Do you know what I mean? And it's just, it's constantly just walloping you over the head with its points and its themes. And it is kind of like, it's very much, it's Ari Aster's first film. And it does have that thing that first films have a lot, where it kind of feels like someone going, do you see, at you a lot during the course of it. And actually this time around, I found it very off-putting, and it felt long. Like, it's never felt that long to me before, and it is a long movie, but this time around, by the end, I was just like, okay, there's another half hour of this. I kind of just want this to stop now, actually.
I mean, I agree in so much as I think this time I kind of was like, yeah, the fact that it's his first film comes across in, it's such a weird kind of compromised film, because as you say, there's tonally and atmospherically, it's incredible, and it still is. And there are moments of genuine, like, utterly unique horror. That's one of the things I like about it. The horror that I feel is a very specific thing, and it's not Lynchian, and it's not, you know, it's a quite unique, disturbing feeling that he can reach. But also the clunkiness of it this time around, like the literal grinding of the gears as the plot is kind of wrenched into kind of shape. And there's moments where, like, people behave really stupidly, and it is really, like, for a film that has kind of a fairly high degree of emotional intelligence, I think, it's kind of got like a really, like, it's almost like you needed someone to be like, that's not how a plot works. For those who haven't seen Hereditary, and I'm sure everyone listening has, it is about a series of traumas really befalling a family. It is actually, I think I described it as using grief as a weapon. Trauma porn is another thing that it could be kind of accused of being. And I was quite interested. I read an interview with Ari Aster, and he sort of said, oh yes, I'm drawing on, you know, experiences from my life, but I'm not going to say what, because it's, you know, it's not specifically my setup, but it's just, and I thought, yeah, I'm not surprised that he answered that way, because I think there is, while it feels authentic, the traumatization and the grief, it also feels exploitative and, like I say, being used as a sort of blunt instrument, really.
See, that's exactly what I thought that this third time round when I was watching it. I was like, this film is to, you know, is to grief what, like, The Cruel Jaws is to sharks, or also She, Woman of the SS is to death camps. Do you know what I mean? It is basically just dragging your face through the most miserable experiences you can possibly imagine. And it's using it as ballast, as like a hook to hang a film on. It's like its hook, it's like its gimmick almost, is its use of grief. And that doesn't bother me, because exploitation generally does not bother me. People have always exploited things when they're making art. We can go back to Shakespeare, you know, as we already have, suddenly. You know, we can go back to Shakespeare. That's, you know, all art really is exploitation of some degree or another. But with this, it's almost gleeful in its complete, impenetrably murky misery. Yeah. You know, it's taking, and that, like, one of the things I really noticed about it this time round is how much it feels like, and you know, and obviously this is set out, like one of the metaphors of this film is that the Toni Collette character, she creates these miniatures. Mm. So to all intents and purposes, she's creating these little dolls' houses. And this film is so much like watching someone getting angry at their dolls.
Yeah.
Just making them go through the worst things they can possibly imagine. But to the extent where, like, because of its length and because of its relentlessness, by the end, I was tired and I was numb.
Mm.
This third time around, I was, and also, like, there are points, and it's difficult with Astor because his shorts he directed before this are kind of dark comedies.
Mm.
Midsummer, as we've talked about before, does have quite a lot of humour in it. It is quite a funny film. And with this, there's these occasional sparks of, like, proper, I think, comedy. Like, I think they're meant to be funny. There's bits where you're definitely meant to sort of, like, I think, chuckle blackly.
Yeah.
But even with that sort of slight leavening, I found the experience of it just really numbing, actually.
Yeah.
And I was very tired by the end of it. And it, maybe that's the point. Like I say, I think he's made the film he wants to make. But as a viewer, like by the end, I was just like, I actually just kind of wanted this to stop about half an hour ago.
It's interesting again because I read an interview and a couple of reviews where people were saying, you know, what's so impressive about this is that, you know, it is a horror film, but you know, this it's a thing I hate in critics where they do it, but they're basically sort of sidelining the actual genre side of it and saying, you know, really, you almost don't need the horror because it's a compelling family drama. And I was like, no, I think the horror feels more original and more interesting and to me more confident. And the family, the grieving and the trauma stuff, whilst the acting is amazing. So Toni Collette, first of all, you know, dials it up, but she is believably difficult and broken in her kind of grief and trauma. And I think that the son, Alex, I'm blanking on the actor's name.
Alex Wolff.
Oh, he's called Alex Wolff. That's right. I can't remember.
Yeah.
He is also brilliant. Yeah. I mean, I think he has a lot to do and I think he does it very, very well. But, you know, it's almost like the acting is great and it drives it along. But there is something a bit juvenile about the sort of the wallowing in that. Sometimes it gels really well in the film and other times it doesn't. Other times it feels like you're being put through, like you say, like you're watching someone play with their dollies in a horrible, mean-spirited way.
Yeah, like someone burning ants with a magnifying glass.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, it really has that. And it sort of reminded me that of that bit in the Flex Mentallo, the Grant Morrison comic Flex Mentallo, where there's that brilliant bit where one of the characters is just kind of says, like, only a child would mistake darkness and misery for adulthood, you know, for grown-up content. And I did get that thing where it was like, after I'd been through a couple of hours of it, I was like, there is actually something slightly juvenile about its total insistence on the darkness of its worldview. It does have that kind of, like, Hot Topic goth kind of vibe to it. Do you know what I mean? And I'd never noticed that before. It was only this time around where I was just like, to not allow any chink of light in it. I mean, he's creating an atmosphere and I understand that. But after a while, it does start to feel a little bit like, Mum, look at me, I'm so dark and weird. And that's quite tough. Once you notice that, it becomes very hard to unnotice. And yeah. I don't, you know, maybe I'm not being entirely fair, I'm probably not, but like once I'd noticed it, it became quite difficult to stop noticing it. And actually by the end, I was even sort of laughing at the bits that were meant to be horrible. Yeah. Like the bit at the end, like the bit that really, and it fucking cracked me up actually, and I know it shouldn't have done. So you know, spoilers here, but like you said, me previously, you know, when they're at the end, they're leading Peter out of the house and up into the treehouse, and he looks to the right in the garden. What does he see in the garden? It's the dog's body. It's the dead dog. it's just like they get to the end, and they're just like, yeah, throw in a dead dog as well. Kill the dog. It's just like, and I'm not one of these kind of like dweeby horror fans that gets really upset about people killing dogs in movies. I couldn't give a shit. But it's like to do that just felt really just like, oh, come on. It just became unintentionally hilarious, you know.
You know, the reason we picked it as in this, the reason it's sort of thematically so kind of aligned really is because it deals with inherited trauma in a way. It's about, it is a film that focuses on Toni Collette as the mother of a household. We begin the film and she is processing the death of her mother. And what you get, fairly artfully kind of, is that, it wasn't a hugely, I say it's artful. I mean, she pretty much spells it out in her eulogy, but it's not, her mother is a difficult person and not necessarily a warm person. And, you get the feeling that, again, I think that Toni Collette really sells this, that she herself has a lot of kind of damage that's been done from having this slightly frosty, distant and weird mother. And a lot of the power of the film is about her relationship to her child, really, and the guilt she feels for the fact that she, questions loving him and punishes him for the act that drives the film along. And all that stuff's like really, potent and strong. But it's sort of in service of just a kind of Cod Rosemary's Baby story, really. So I wasn't sure, whilst I think there's some sort of compelling believability in the sort of the idea of that, you can't escape your parents and that you could continue to damage people in the way that you were damaged and you might try and change things and blah blah blah, but I didn't really feel it was telling me a lot about the family unit or the complexities of family, because there was this like really sort of hokey and quite obvious Rosemary's Baby satanic cult story going on. So that kind of is it limits really what it was saying to me about family. I wasn't sure at the end of the day, Alex Wolff's character, the son, he's just a sort of teenage boy. He's selfish and self-absorbed, but he's also just, he's just a teenage boy. He's going to parties. He's trying to hook up with the pretty girl. He's neither the cool kid nor the awkward kid. He's somewhere in between, blah, blah, blah. But, I didn't feel like there was anything particularly revelatory or interesting or about the dynamic. It felt pretty standard. It's just a bit, it's a funny thing, really. I think you can feel like it's kind of thematically really rich, and then actually it's thematically really quite obvious. Yes. And the richness is actually that he derives some genuinely fucked up, really unsettling moments of horror.
Yeah.
There's about two or three things in this film that really fucked me up, and they continue to fuck me up,
Yeah.
And that's impressive.
Oh, I would agree. I mean, this is it. All this criticism comes with a caveat. I mean, I would agree entirely that this is a film that is about itself. It isn't actually really about anything. In the same, like, it's a roller coaster. It's a scare delivery system. But those scares are all timers. Nearly every single one is an all timer in this film, and it's so refreshing seeing a horror film and looking at scares and going, and not immediately knowing what it's referencing. And it's funny how often you give that a pass. If you think of 90% of the horror films you watch, pretty much all of the scares in them, you'll be like, I know that type of scare. Whether it's a lank-haired ghost girl or a knocking in the door or a cat jumping out or whatever. You know the context of that scare. And nearly all of the scares in this feel really original, or at least like really interesting twists on the usual, and all of which is aided by the atmosphere, the way it's shot, the way the camera movement in this film is fucking crazy. Like the way he uses camera, right, moves around the family home, the way the home has been decked out so that everything feels like the surfaces, the walls just sort of end, so everything does feel like a doll's house, so they are enclosed. And it's that attention to
no one ever looks comfy, do they?
Yeah.
They never look comfy. No one's relaxing at any point in this film.
Yeah, it's really clever. That it's that atmosphere and those scares that make this movie, but it's not really the plot. Because as you say, the plot is quite rote. It's pretty it's pretty standard. You know, the idea of an inherited evil is pretty normal, you know.
And also, I think it goes beyond that and goes into some fairly tasteless territory. And I know, I remember you, when we talked about this, when we first saw it, I remember you sort of saying that you found the idea of a kind of inherited mental illness to be a bit tacky and a bit kind of ill-formed or something. You know, this idea that her mum was a mess and so she's a mess, and, you know, it was a bit...
It you know, I don't like the term problematic because it's incredibly non-specific, and to be honest, I think it's used way too much. But it's a little crude, the way that the idea of mental illness is used. There's no real explanation of the type of mental illness. I mean, she rips, you know, there's that bit where she's in the help group at the beginning, and she reels off a whole bunch of names and a whole bunch of different types of things like DID and things like that people have. But it's never really referred back to. It feels more like sort of set dressing. You know what I mean? The actual thing that her mum, her matriarch, suffered from that's being handed down to the family is evil, Dan. That's what she actually suffers from, is being evil. And, you know, having mental illness equated with evil, I mean, fuck it. Like I've said before in the programme, as someone who is affected by mental illness, it doesn't actually bother me that much in horror movies because I'm just so kind of used to it. And usually it's cheap and it's funny and it just sort of makes me chuckle. But in a film that's this relentlessly self-serious,
it
takes on a bit more of a tone, and it does make me take its claims to be about something a little bit more seriously. And in that case, this film, Hereditary, is kind of lacking.
Yeah.
There are so many bits in this film, like, you know, the fact that they're studying, you know, the inevitability of fate in Greek tragedy in the English class. Like, even at that point, I was like, I get it. I fucking get it. It's fine. You don't have to keep pushing. You know what I mean? It's like someone grabbing you by both sides of the head and forcing you around to look at stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm fully on board. You don't need to do this. And like I say, it's a very typical first filmmaker mistake. It's a rookie error. Lots of first filmmakers do it. But in a film that's so relentlessly self-serious as this, it just stands out a lot more. Those bits where you do find yourself going, oh yeah, that's clunky, in a film that takes itself this seriously, means it just stands out so much more. Because you're on a different footing when you're looking at something like this. Do you know what I mean? You are going to be less forgiving because this film is completely unforgiving on the viewer.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like, so you know, you are going to be less forgiving in return. And I found that this sort of over exposition, like I say, this third time around, first time around, I barely noticed it. And I remember Mark Kermode, who, you know, obviously I have my differences, Mark Kermode, we all do, but usually 9 times out of 10, me and him are on the same page. Mm-hmm. And his first review of this, which he did on his Radio 1 show, he basically said exactly what I'm saying now. And there was a younger bloke going, oh, Mark, you're completely wrong. You're just pissed off because people are comparing it to The Exorcist. And he was like, no, look, watch the film. Look, it's just hammering you over the head. Also, and I was with your younger guy. I was just like, come on, Mark, it's a modern classic. And watching it again, it's like, yeah, Kermode, bang on. Absolutely bang on. He absolutely nailed this film. It's a constant over exposition. And it's like you could lose half an hour if you got rid of most of it.
You could, yeah. And it wouldn't matter because, you know, there's literally a bit where the mum realizes what's happened by looking through some photo albums and books that are like, you know, how to raise the devil and put it in your child.
one of the books in the book she reads has been has had yellow permanent marker gone over it. It's been highlighted. God, come on, mate, I can fucking read. Do you know what I mean?
But to focus on the good stuff though, because I do still think Ari Aster is a really interesting filmmaker. There is a kind of Kubrickian level of control. He's a certain kind of sense of, you know, playing with dolls that Kubrick has. I think Kubrick's concerns were much, 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 much bigger. You know, that's the reason Kubrick gets lost isn't so close to people is because he's thinking about bigger stuff. That is, it's a cliche, but it's true. And, you know, when we decided to do About Families, obviously we decided we weren't going to do The Shining because, we're never going to do The Shining. But there is, you know, the clear moment in The Shining where Jack is looking down at the model of the maze that's in the Overlook Hotel, and it zooms down, and he sees Danny and his wife running around the maze, and you get this kind of weird moment of like, what's going on here? And it's like, you know, this film does that about 50 times. It's like, yeah, like, do you see, she's got these models, and she said, you know, people are playing with it, you know. Yeah, so you know, the clear lineage to Kubrick is there, but there is a remarkable sense of control for a first film. It is like very, very controlled, and the claustrophobic atmosphere is still there. And I genuinely think, like, there's a couple of horror moments that I want to talk about. The kind of second traumatic act of the film, which is the death of, again, spoilers, apologies, the death of Charlie, who dies in a very horrible way. Because she's having an allergic reaction. The older brother was supposed to be looking after her at a party, didn't look after her, went and got high. I mean, it's like some 50s morality tale. She starts to have an allergic reaction. He's driving in a panic to get her to her EpiPen. Why she hasn't got her EpiPen, I don't know. Anyone who is that allergic does not forget their EpiPen, but they do if you're writing a script and you want to make that thing happen. Yeah. You know, they could have had a thing where she dropped her EpiPen and broke it, but they didn't. They just said, oh, she's forgotten it anyway. But anyway, so she leans out the side of the kind of window of the car, and he's driving, and it's at night, and he loses control of the car, and she hits a lamppost and essentially is decapitated. Now, that is a very exploitative thing that happens to her, and it's a very contrived thing that happens to her. It's very horrid. But the way Astor does it is one of the most upsetting things I've ever seen in a film, the way he plays that out, because he chooses to focus on the brother's face. And there's just this very long sequence where, after it's happened, and we know something bad has happened, and he knows something bad has happened, and he knows that his sister's body is on the back seat of the car, and he knows she's dead. He knows it. And it's just his face. And he, I think at one point, sort of almost goes to say, are you okay? And then just doesn't bother because he knows she's not. And then he doesn't scream. He doesn't overreact. He just drives home and gets into bed. And he just gets into bed and doesn't tell his parents that what's happened. And so, you know, Toni Collette finds out when she goes to the car in the morning. So he goes to bed and he's lying. And there is something so believable about that.
Yeah.
That when something so appalling happens, and it is your fault, and it was your fault that it happened, you know, it is a terrible accident, but he is responsible. His reaction is so believable and so dark. And that feeling of lying in bed, you know, he's just trying to hope that if he goes to bed, maybe when he wakes up, it won't be true what's happened. And in fact, what he wakes up is hearing his mother making like the most animal sounds of grief that you could hear, you know. And it just is like, yeah, and now I've got to go and see mum and dad and be like, yeah, so this is, and it is, you know, there are no jump scares in it. There's nothing overtly supernatural. We do get a suggestion, you know, it's being caused by the conspiracy or whatever, but it's such a fucking horrid moment. And it hit me again this time. It's really devastating and it's really effective. And this is the key act that sets the film into where it is. All the silly supernatural shenanigans that are going on in the background with seances and satanic cults, it's this kind of like deep trauma thing. And I think that Astor nails it in that moment. I think it's fucking appalling and really upsetting.
It's the standout scene from the film, and it is the believably teenage reaction.
Yeah,
you know, that thing of just like I can't cope with this. I'm just going to go to sleep. I'm just going to deal with this in the morning. You know, and it's, you know, to a lesser degree when you fucked something up and you know your parents are going to be mad. We all did that when we were kids.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like it's something everyone's done. I found like that's an amazing moment. But actually, what struck me this time around was like how much I enjoyed a lot of the more sort of rote technical scares.
Yeah.
Like the shot when right at the end, when Peter sat on the edge of the bed and you just see his mum scuttling along the wall.
Oh.
behind him. And there's no sound. It doesn't make any sound. There's no scritchy, scratchy, scritchy. It's just, it's completely soundless. And she just
she almost flies through the air. In a
She's sort of gliding, isn't she? But she's it's terrifying. I mean, you know, the hairs on the arm have gone up. It was those sort of technical scares this time round. I found myself kind of going, how did they do that? That's really clever. That's really good. Like,
The bit where he's having a bad time and he's at school, and there's the bit where he looks round at himself, and he looks round at a reflection in a kind of cabinet while he's in a lesson. And it's just, it's the way his reflection is really smugly smiling back at him.
Yeah.
Is really horrible, because it's not like grimacing or kind of looking like an evil version of himself. It's just smiling really benignly at him. And that's really fucking horrible. And then he has this kind of weird sort of epileptic seeming moment. He has a fit of sorts, but it's really horrible the way his arm shoots in the air and his face is kind of distorting. It's really horrid. It's really like just palpably and viscerally horrid, that moment. And I really liked it. I was like, oh, this is really scary.
That's always going to be the stuff that I really, really like about this film is the technicality of it. It's the scares. It's the way, when it comes to the sort of the big jump stuff, it never overplays its hand, and it always has something in place that you haven't seen before. And it's only when you watch a film like this that you realise how fucking rare that is. You know, if you watch as much horror as you and I do, like, we're used to a certain amount of, like, you know, contextual understanding. And to see something like Hereditary, it does feel like the rug's being pulled out from under you. It's like the first time you watch Suspiria or something like that.
Yeah.
When, you know, that first time the knife goes into the heart and you see the heart and you're like, fuck no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It feels a bit like watching that. It's got that kind of this vibe of just like, I just can't believe that you've done that. You know, yeah. And like I say, I will always respect and enjoy to an extent this film and have a hell of a lot of time for it. But I just, because of its unsubtlety, because of its sophomoric approach to its to its miserable tone, I'm just never going to love it. Do you know what I mean? It's interesting that you talk about Kubrick, because again, he's one of these directors that has a reputation as being kind of unlovable, and I think that Astor has, and certainly in my case, you know, I have a very complicated relationship with Kubrick's films. But that does tend to be my problem with him. And it seems in Astor's case, he hasn't just learned the technical tricks from the master. He's actually ended up kind of replicating what I see as his major flaw, is that this film is kind of unlovable. Mm. It's not about anything other than itself. It constantly holds you at a distance while pushing your head around to show you what it wants you to see. Mm. It never trusts you to make your own mind up. And after a while, especially after a few watches, I found myself resenting that. I found myself just kind of going, I'm an adult, and I kind of resent being told how to feel constantly, bludgeoned into feeling a particular way.
Yeah, no, it is. It there's some really good stuff in there. And I think, as you said, having a genuine new sensation in horror, and I mean an actual sensation while you're watching, where you aren't in comfortable territory, you don't know what's coming, that is really exciting, and that's why I'm really interested in him. And I think, you know, he refined some of that and did something different with Midsommar. Yeah. Although, again, Midsommar, another film that uses grief like a weapon and a blunt instrument, and is overlong and overplays its hand in a lot of instances. So I do wonder whether it's just going to be one of those things where you start to go, oh, I see, this is always going to be a thing I have to factor in when I'm watching your films. But that kind of raw new voice in horror thing is really exciting, and it doesn't come along very often. So definitely a more juvenile film than I realised, and that will be what kind of ages it badly. And as I get older, I'm sure I will just be more harsh on it. You know, because as a parent, there was things I could really kind of, I really felt, and I really felt like the kind of the awful loss of a child. You know, I really felt that. But then I also was like, you're not a parent, I don't think. So some of this stuff doesn't, it feels a bit, yeah, like this is what you think adults who are grieving about their, you know. So it is worth saying, I do think Toni Collette is, she's become like the horror mum of the last, I don't know, like 20 years. So, you know, it starts in The Sixth Sense. She's the mum in that.
Yeah.
And she went from being in things like Muriel's Wedding and kind of Kooky Fair to being like this young mum character in Sixth Sense. And then it's like, now it's just like, if you need a horror mum, it's Toni Collette time. And she's in Krampus. She plays a, you know, she's a horror mum in that. And in this, she's a real horror mum.
In Krampus, she's definitely rehearsing her I'm shocked and horrified expression, isn't she? Like that famous Hereditary photo of like just the close up of her face looking utterly petrified is like, that's in Krampus like several times. But Krampus is obviously a lot funnier. Krampus is kind of like the comedy Hereditary, really, isn't it?
It's a bit like when No Country for Old Men came out at the same time as There Will Be Blood, and it was like really hard to remember where one started and the other ended. I have it with Krampus and Hereditary because even like the palette of it is not that dissimilar.
No,
and I do think Krampus perhaps has more to say about families. That's like a bit more potent, you know.
Yeah, no, I think you might be right.
Might be obvious, but it resonates a bit more. But Hereditary, it's a good film. I do really like it, but it was interesting to come at it with a much more critical eye. So
I will not be watching it again for a very, very long time.
No, not for a while. Yeah,
it's definitely not, years.
It's not a throw it on and feel better film. You did write to me the other day and say that you watched Rawhead Rex again just for fun, and I was like, that is a throw it on and feel better film. Yeah. But it's, you know, tonally the next film I think couldn't be more different, really.
It could not.
And it's a bit of a tonic really after the heavy slog of Hereditary, and that is
we are going to talk about Ready or Not from 2019.
I honestly can't wait to be a part of your film.
There's just one more thing. At midnight, you have to play a game.
A game?
It's just something we do when someone new joins the family.
What game? Hide and seek? Are we really going to play that? So there's no way for me to win, right?
I mean, stay hidden till dawn.
No, thank you.
Good luck. They think they had to kill you before sunrise.
If we don't find her and perform the ritual, we're all dead!
Found her.
Very different kettle of fish from Hereditary. This is the second time I've seen it, and it's the first time you've seen it, so you should go first. Of course, that seems to be the rules, doesn't it, now? So,
they are the rules, and who are we to argue with them?
Absolutely.
Ready or Not is it's an interesting film. I enjoyed it, but my overall feeling was it's a film that has a kind of a theme and an idea, and then it doesn't do anything with that beyond some fairly basic thrills and spills. So what we're dealing with is a sort of satirical black comedy horror wherein a newlywed couple go to visit the family of the groom. He comes from a sort of aristo moneyed family who live in a mansion from something out of a horror movie, you know, a large sprawling mansion. Samara Weaving plays the bride, who is not from that kind of moneyed background, and she is kind of there to, you know, to meet the family and to make a good impression and blah, blah, blah. And he is a bit nervous about this. He's like, my family are a bit weird, you know, so far so predictable. There then turns out to be a sort of arcane tradition in that family that on the wedding night, I think it is the wedding night, isn't it? That whoever is the bride or groom, whoever is, you know, the new entry to the family has to play a game. And they choose from a number of games. It's a kind of random selection. And Samara Weaving's character ends up picking Ready or Not, which we call Hide and Seek.
It is called, to be fair, it is called Hide and Seek in the film, I think.
Right, okay. Oh, yes, so Ready or Not is, yeah. So essentially, what then transpires is that the family have a long-standing deal with the devil that means that if they do not sort of follow the rules of the game, then something awful will happen to them. But the benefits of this is that they've obviously made a lot of money. So it's kind of real, you know, they sold their souls to the devil, blah, blah, blah. And then a bunch of fairly inexperienced, spoiled, moneyed aristos with a bunch of arcane weaponry hunt Samara Weaving around the grounds of and inside of the house. So it becomes a sort of a deadly game of hide and seek. And that is a fun setup for a film. Don't get me wrong, right? That is a fun setup for a film. And the film itself is fun to a degree. But it just feels like you know what the film is because everything in the advertising of the film told you that's the hook, you know. The trailer tells you, every review tells you. And so you go in, you're like, I know what's going to happen. So there is the big thing it has in, you know, in its favor is this element of like, and then it goes weird, but you know it's going to go weird. So that's a bit kind of spoiled. But the film itself also, because it sort of almost knows that you'll be in on that, it doesn't, there is no tension. You know it's going to happen, it happens. And then, you know, chaos ensues. And it is fun, but I just felt there was a better and more interesting and more genuinely subversive film that could have been made that wasn't made. And, you know, we've said it before and we'll say it again. You can't critique a film for being something that you wanted it to be, for not being that thing. But I really felt that there was a really good, toothy, muscular satire exploitation film to be made. And this just ended up going down the most obvious roots of, you know, a bit of reasonably gruesome carnage and a little bit of satire and a little bit of commentary about class and privilege and things, but really it didn't have a huge amount to say, and it didn't say it in a particularly interesting way. That's my kind of ultimate takeaway, I think.
I pretty much agree with you, but the things that this film has in its favor that work are, for me, for my money, just really, really fun. Right, for a start, Samara Weaving, who is basically, as she is the first breakout action hero of the 21st century. Have you seen Mayhem that she's in, that's on Shudder?
No, that's Joe, what's his name, isn't it? The guy who made Wrong Turn 2 and things like that.
Oh, it might be. Yes, I think it might be. Like, she's rich. It's a similar setup. It's the enclosed space violence happening to people kind of set. And she's terrific in that. And I haven't seen Guns Akimbo, which she's also in with Daniel Radcliffe. But that, again, it looks like the same sort of knockabout violence.
She's in The Babysitter, I think, which is a bad film, but she is pretty good in it.
She was very good in the new Bill and Ted film as well. Yeah. I think she's just got a really charismatic, entertaining presence, and I can just watch her in anything.
I agree 100%. She is the best thing in this film by a country mile, basically.
Well, no, Dan, she's not the best thing in this film, because the other, oh my God, I love seeing him back. We have Adam Brody, my friend. We have Seth fucking Cohen in the house. A little bit of history for our listeners. It must be said that when me and Dan first met over 20 years ago, nearly 20 years ago, one of the first things we ever really bonded over was a shared love of the OC, wasn't it?
A shared love of watching the OC with a crippling hangover on a Sunday.
So as a result, my love of Adam Brody is kind of deeply, deeply infused.
The ageless Adam Brody as well.
Oh my God.
When you say 20 years, you're like, oh, fuck, it is quite old, that show. And it's like, he does not look any different.
Yeah. And actually, I really like him as the kind of feckless, drunk brother. I think he's really good in this film. And actually, I think all the performances by the kind of like the 1% psychopaths are actually really entertaining.
Really fun, yeah. I think Andy McDowell, it was great to see Andy McDowell.
Yeah.
Not playing a simpering, bland love interest and actually playing a kind of the opposite, really. She was great. And her sort of natural beauty gone slightly, you know, it's got a slightly hard-edged look now. She's a bit older. which worked really well. And I thought Andy McDowell was cracking in it as well, which is, I don't say that normally.
And I absolutely love, I didn't write her name down, which is a disservice to her, but I love the woman that played the nan, you know, the really evil nan with the axe that's taking it all way too seriously. Because she's clearly based her performance on, you know, when Terry Gilliam pops up in Python sketches, and he's always just like, when he's always just like gurning constantly, just like she's clearly based herself on Terry Gilliam. She is like something out of a fucking Python sketch, and I really enjoyed her.
It felt like the directors wanted to have a note of high camp, and that was her. It was like a sort of throwback to a almost like quasi Rocky Horror sort of vibe with her, you know, even the way she was made up and stuff, and the fact that she was acting in a completely different film, you know. She was the absolute believer as well. The rest of the family were like, yeah, there's this satanic pact we've done, we don't know if it's real or not. She 100% was like, it is real. You know, she's the stickler for the rules in the family, which I do think is quite funny. You do always have like someone in the family who takes the rules too seriously when you're playing a board game. You know, that's a fun idea. Yeah,
and I liked the sort of the feckless, coked up daughter-in-law as well. He was killing people accidentally. Just like all the bits of this film that are fun are really fun. Do you know what I mean? All the bits that are good are really good. On a more sort of like, you know, on a more structural basis, it's another of those films that I've seen recently, like The Raid or a film of that nature, which has a very computer gamey feel to how it levels up.
Yeah.
So it has a very kind of, this is the first level in the corridor. This is the second level when you're in the stables. This is the third level when you're out in the garden. And when a film like this does that, it's always it's really good because it adds variety. And the way that it moved from each part, from each sort of level, if you will, gave it the vibe of one of the games that I used to really love, which was the Metal Gear Solid games. I used to really love the Metal Gear games. You know, it had that sort of vibe, the sort of stealth and the sort of like, here's a problem and getting around it, using the cameras and stuff. And I really enjoyed the sort of the gaminess of it. And if it had kept going on the sort of track until the end, I probably would have just been like, I fucking love this film. But it kind of flattens. It kind of gets about halfway through. And it's like, what should be a film about Samara Weaving popping out of corridors, delivering one-liners and killing a bunch of rich people, it's never going to get off. It just sort of doesn't do that.
No, and I started watching it going, okay, right, I know where this is going, and you know, each of the family members will be like an end of level boss. They'll start off with the easy ones. You'll get up and up, and eventually it'll be like, you know, her versus whichever is deigned to be the most deadly of the family, perhaps, you know. And no, it doesn't do that. Like a couple of, I think one or two of them, but mainly a bunch of like servants get iced. Yeah. And then they all come together at the end so that it can have its kind of punchline moment, which I get, but I think you could have done the same thing with one or two of the family being left and the rest of them. And I think, again, I would have been up for it if it had dialed it up and gone, right, it's a film we watched, which we were going to talk about, but we felt ultimately there wasn't enough kind of meat on the bone, really, was the recent Russian film, Why Don't You Just Die?
I just love saying that title. Why Don't You Just Die?
It's a great title. And I'm not going to talk long about it, but the director's kinetic style is like the inheritor of the crown from like Sam Raimi, Peter Jackson and Robert Rodriguez. It's like the next guy to really just have that utterly muscular and kinetic and exciting camera work. And the first 15 of that minutes of that film are just insane, you know, and I have really felt like Ready or Not needed a bit of that. It needed to go like, let's dial it up. And when, you know, in order to kind of lean into the ridiculous nature of the kind of plot, I think it could have gone there with like a few really crazy camera angles, some like holes being blown through people, cameras traveling through those holes. You know, what's the guy who did Kitamura?
Ryu Kitamura, yeah.
Yeah, like a bit of that kind of grotesque, over-the-top camera work really would have helped this film in a way. I mean, if you're going down that particular route, and I felt like it was going down that route, and then, as you say, it sort of plateaued and didn't get there. So there's just a few bits of her just kind of running around, and then kind of, you know, she's back in the house, and you're like, okay, well, it lost its momentum completely.
It's a sadly kind of slightly bland-looking film as well. I found myself getting a little bit tired of the sort of washed-out sort of yellow and black colour palette of it after a while. That got a bit tiresome, and that went throughout the film. It didn't seem to matter what sort of situation she found herself in. That seemed to be a constant. Like the actual mechanics of how it moved, I thought were quite good. But then occasionally it would just stop, and you'd have scenes where, you know, Andy McDowell would talk to, you know, her son for a while about the sort of lore of the family, and you're like, I don't care.
Yeah,
you literally, like, you have one thing to do here. Like the gold standard for this kind of film is You're Next. That is the absolute gold standard for this kind of film. What I wanted was You're Next versus Rich People, and that's what it promised.
Yeah,
that's what it promised. So
it's interesting you say You're Next, because I was watching it and I thought, this is two films coming together. This is Get Out and You're Next coming together, and Get Out and You're Next are better than both. You know, like. If you combine those and gone, and the target is rich white people, or just rich people, you know, a class thing, that would have been great.
It would have been.
Yeah, you're out.
Well, get next.
I think you're out is more appropriate.
Good, I like that.
Whilst Get Out is too often the go-to film for people to go, oh, well, a great horror film for the last 50 years. It's a great film, don't get me wrong.
We've talked about it before.
But what's so good about it is it's that perfect thing where the metaphor works and the film works, and they work together, and they really use each other. The metaphor and the mechanics of the film really use each other, and it really comes together. So it's jointly satisfying. It's a really potent allegory, and it's a really potent genre film with like a satisfying arc, and this just gets its thing and it just hangs there. It doesn't ever fucking deliver on, like, it doesn't, you know, it's a quite lovable film in a lot of ways. I think that's the thing, is it's a good time film, and I get that, you know, it can't all be like Le Grand Bouffe or Festen or something. It can't be like this kind of devastating kind of hardcore takedown of class and family and society and stuff. But I really was just like, it's a shame that it doesn't really have anything to say about rich people. It doesn't, does it? I mean, there's a few cheap shots about servants getting killed and stuff, and they're, you know, they're spoiled, so they're no good at hunting, which is, that's a funny idea, that they're not good at hunting, because of course why would they be? Yeah. Although I think the narrative, again, talked about with Hereditary, I think some of it's a bit clunky, and I think the, you know, for a film that's all about games and rules and kind of, it didn't make it clear that it seemed to be that if you got hide and seek when you're picking your game, that's the deadly one, but they aren't all deadly.
Yes.
And so the idea is that the family haven't had to do this before, so they're crap at hunting, but I don't think that came across. I felt at the start it was like they've all been through this, and, you know, you either survive or you don't, or whatever. Do you know what I mean? It was like,
It was a little unclear.
It was unclear that basically what it was a sacrifice. So she got hide and seek, and that is the sacrifice. It's just that they hunt you down. And that's what happens to the auntie character at the start. And that's why she's so kind of bitter and adherent to the rules and all stuff. But to me, and it may just have been me watching it not quite paying enough attention, but I just don't think they quite nailed that. Has this family murdered people or not? I'm not clear.
It did take time out to sort of explain its lore, but it kept kind of explaining all the wrong bits.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I wonder if there were some bits left on the floor that would have made it a bit too long, that maybe would have nailed it a little bit harder. I mean, there are some really nice set pieces in it. The bit where she has to drag herself out of the stable using a rusty nail and a hole in her hand is really good.
And it's got a great moment where she punches a 12-year-old or something. Yeah. That's good as well.
anything involving, hilarious violence happening to children any regular listener of this podcast will know I am absolutely all for. Absolutely. But it's just like I say, it's like the fun bits were so fun. And it's like, it could have been a much simpler movie and it would have been a better movie. And also just like, dude, you know where we're all living now. You know what we're going through. I want to see a bunch of rich pricks getting killed in various inventive and horrible ways.
There's a good bit where, she finally loses her shit with one of the members of the family and kind of beats them to death fairly brutally. And this new thing I've noticed, which is a go-to thing in films, which is like really lovingly depicted head and face trauma. So yeah, in a film that is like fun, gory for the majority of it. I mean, she's, she goes through some stuff. There's a bit of the Die Hard about her, she's kind of... she goes through it a bit, Samara Weaving. So, it's not that it's like fun in it, there is a sort of visceral violence to it. But suddenly you're just like cutting someone's face getting beaten in. That just seems to happen in a lot of films. And I've just noticed that. It's like, it's almost like that we've realised we can, so we will.
it's what I call a post-irreversible move, that one.
Yeah. It's like after the first squib in a film where you realise that rather than someone shooting a cap out of a pistol and someone clutching their chest and falling over, you could have an explosive like jet of blood. And that was just like a turning point in film. I was like, oh fuck, there's people who've dedicated their whole career to like just that. And in some way, it's like the face trauma, like you say, irreversible is like, hey, you could do face trauma really well now. And it's like, fuck, let's put it in every film then.
It's like what happened to sort of shooting people with heavy duty machine guns happened after that that Rambo sequel, wasn't it?
Yeah. Right?
You can make guns turn people into soup now. It's just like, we're going to put that in fucking everything. It's wicked. And it is. Don't get me wrong. It's wicked.
Yeah, no, I'm not doing that.
I love it.
Seeing people come apart like ragdolls as bullets hit them. It's like, you and I have waited our whole life for this.
Yeah.
What a golden age we're in. I think ultimately that was my problem with it, was that I started watching it and I was like, I know where this is going. And you did say to me, because I sort of voiced a bit of slight kind of like meh-ness about it, and you said, look, stick the ending though, because it is worth hanging around for. And that's why we ended up kind of actually talking about it on this. But it does have a great sort of like swerve at the end. I do really like that. And I like it kind of being like, yeah, don't worry, we're going to do it. Don't worry, we're going to go there. And that was really good. But I just sort of, it was just the lack of surprise and the lack of novelty. And it just felt like, give Verhoeven this, give a European this. There was something about, and the guys who made it are, I think, behind some of the pretty good segments. There are certainly the good, really good Haunted House segment in the first VHS is this team.
Yes. So their names are Max Bettinelli Olpin and Tyler Gillett, and they direct under the name Radio Silence.
That's it, Radio Silence, yeah. And so they in the VHS anthology, they do a really cracking Haunted House thing. But it's interesting because it's a roller coaster segment. It literally is like going on a ride. And there's something about American horror fan dude bros who know their shit. I'm not dismissing them. But you know what I mean? They're like, I bet they're kind of like, they're horror fans. They've wanted to make horror. Now they're making horror. And so they get given this. It's a great script. It's a great idea. It's like, bam, but you just stick it on and it's like, I know where this is going. And lo and behold, it goes exactly where. And in some degrees, it doesn't go far enough. And in some areas, it's a bit under. But it's just like, fuck, man, this could have been amazing. This could have been a really great, satire and a brutal exploitation movie and funny. And, I don't know. It feels just like they didn't quite nail it. Although I think largely, a lot of people really liked it. So, it's definitely a fun, crowd-pleasing film.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think for me, and it was really interesting because the first time I watched this, I watched it immediately after I went to Knives Out. And that was actually...
Another really similar film, right?
Yeah, but it was a really good antidote to Knives Out. And I enjoyed Knives Out, don't get me wrong. But like this film worked so well immediately after. It was like you couldn't have planned a better double bill.
Yeah.
That worked really well. But yeah, I think my problem with Ready or Not is that at the end of the day, it's a bit timid. You know, it's just a bit timid. And if it had been a bit more courageous about how gung-ho it went, it would be an absolute all-timer in the way that Your Next is, because Your Next works precisely because of its, like, its constant, oh shit, like brutality, you know, the way it uses the sound effects, but the way it's still hilarious constantly throughout.
And it's fast and it's brutal. And also, I think that the family dynamics in Your Next are actually much better sketched in the way that they're a bunch of reasonably prickish upper middle class people coming together for a family get together where there's a bunch of simmering resentment and familial kind of unresolved problems that actually manifest themselves in this really exploitation mode with what is essentially a bit of an unbelievable act by one of the characters, but it works in the film because the tone is set so well. I mean, Your Next is a film that I return to again and again. I have so much affection for it, and I actually, every time I watch it gets better. And I think it was really in the back of my mind while I was watching Ready or Not, going, I think this has been already done. Actually, this is the problem, that you've got your high concept, but that high concept is your elevator pitch to get you in the meeting room, and it never goes beyond that elevator pitch to me. It just flatlines, and that's it. It goes, you know, hey, what about if this kind of the rich hunting the poor, but you know, it was like a game of hide and seek, blah blah, you know, bam, here we go. And it's like, it never really does anything more than that. And I think Your Next is a more interesting spin on that idea of, you know, the person coming into the family who is of a different class, is outside of their little private world, and upends all that. And she upends all that by fucking beating the shit out of a bunch of people in animal masks who are trying to kill the family, who do kill the entire family, you know.
It's sort of ironic that, you know, Ready or Not, which is a sort of almost a more cartoony version of Your Next, ends up suffering because it's not quite cartoony enough.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think that's a bit of a shame. But having said that, if you've had a couple of pints and you're sitting in front of the telly and you're wondering what to watch, you could do a hell of a lot worse than watching watching Ready or Not.
Just to reiterate a point you made, I think Samara Weaving is great in this. Yes. And she has you're instantly on her side, and that is a hard thing to do in films where, you know, it doesn't give you a huge amount of time to get to know and like her, and you do like her, and she has a kind of earthy fun. She seems like a lot of fun. Seems like, yeah, you know why he married her. You know why he's like willing to go against his family. I mean, I think his character and his motivation and his actions are deeply confused and confusing. I think that is one of the big problems the film has.
They don't know what to do with
it. Why is he now doing this? Hold on. How much does he want to do this? How much does he know? And they end up really, I don't know, it just goes wrong with him. But she is just cracking and really, really watchable. And yeah, no, I think she is the big breakaway from this. Is like, the thing that's good about this is like, there's a kind of nice iconic performance, and yeah, she's great. So she sells the film hard, basically, better than it deserves, perhaps.
and obviously Adam Brody.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's just the given. If Seth is in your film,
Adam Brody was going to play the Flash in that failed Justice League film.
I think that would have been perfect.
That would have been amazing, wouldn't it? Things that just, yeah. And that was going to be George Miller directing that as well, wasn't it?
Oh, come on.
George Miller directing the Justice League with Adam Brody as the Flash. Can you fucking imagine?
It's like the fact that Bryan Cranston plays Commissioner Gordon in the fucking animated Year One. It's like, no, he should be in the, you know, whatever film version. Bryan Cranston is the perfect Commissioner Gordon. He's so perfect.
Adam Brody just is fucking Barry Allen. It's really sad.
Okay, so from a you know, the pendulum swings from a cartoonish depiction of family obligation to something entirely less cartoonish and a lot harder.
So yeah, we're going to be looking at Animal Kingdom from 2010.
This boy who's currently being looked after.
Anything you do say can be used as evidence in any later court appearances, you understand?
Yeah.
Tell me if you agree with this. This boy who's being looked after, he knows who you are. And you've done some bad things, sweetie.
Right, so Animal Kingdom, 2010, David Michaud, I believe. Australian family crime drama. And I mean, this was my first time seeing this, so you'd seen it before, hadn't you?
No, same.
Oh, right, okay, cool. I really, really liked this movie. I thought this was really good. I mean, it's we don't really talk about crime a lot on The Savage Beast. Our tastes tend to verge, or certainly the stuff we talk about on the podcast tends to verge more towards the more heightened, the more psychedelic, the more sort of like out there. So this is quite a stripped down family, Australian family crime drama. It has a grittiness, to use an overused term, to it, and a sort of very much more sort of like realistically shot and designed and filmed than the stuff that we usually talk about. But we love all types of films, and yeah, I really enjoyed this film. The basic setup is a character, Josh, who's played by James Francheville, I believe. That's Francheville. I think that's how you pronounce it. His mum dies and he is adopted by his immediate family. And his immediate family, it kind of transpires quite quickly, are basically, they are crims, aren't they? You get the sense that they are bank robbers. They're sort of low-level crims. They're a bit like... you know how we were talking about the criminals in Dead Man's Shoes? They're a bit like those guys, but maybe just a step above. Maybe just that extra step, a little bit more.
They're a local-ish crime family of some notoriety who are having a sort of, an ongoing turf war, but with the police. So there's kind of, that's the framework, isn't it? They're high enough on the radar that the police are kind of always on their case, basically. So
it's the way that this family operates and the way that it works in society, but seen through the eyes of this very passive narrator. This very sort of passive character at the center of it, which we'll talk about that in a bit. And in the course of this, he comes up against the two main characters, one of which is the terrifying grandmother, the matriarch, played by Jackie Weaver, who is called Smurf by all the characters, which is a really good nickname. I really like that. And also Ben Mendelsohn, whose star has erupted over the last 3 years and who's been in the recent Star Wars films and stuff like that, who plays Pope, who is the sort of violently unhinged older brother, who is terrifying.
People bandy around with this whenever you looked at any reviews. It was like, it's the Australian Goodfellas and stuff like that, which is a funny thing because it's Goodfellas is not a realist film. It's not a naturalistic film. And all sorts of reasons it's not that. But I get what it's saying. It's such a compelling kind of low... you're hanging out with lowlifes and you're not being asked to judge, you're just there with them. But just like in Goodfellas, the way that Joe Pesci raised the bar in terms of cinematic psychos that you are genuinely terrified by whenever they're on screen. And I don't even quite understand how they did this with Ben Mendelsohn's character. Just appallingly terrifying.
Yeah.
And in a way that we both grew up in, like, villages, essentially small towns, villages, reasonably rural, and there's those people, and I know you get this in an urban way too, but there's those people that sometimes you just don't know why they're so scary, but they are. And if you ever find yourself around them, every single second is you're on edge because something like but they seem so benign in some way. And he captures that in a way I don't think I've actually seen it done as well on film. Like, genuinely just really scary, but really slight and not physically intimidating, a real good psycho.
he's a really interesting character. He comes back to this kind of character that we've talked about on the show a few times, where he's clearly someone who is attempting to deal with ideas that he's not clever enough to fit into his head.
Yeah.
He's not a bright person, but he understands how to use intimidation, and he has a sort of animal cunning You'll get him out of situations. There's little things they do, like he's wearing the same shirt for nearly the entire film. He's wearing this sort of ghastly sort of green leaf patterned button-up shirt for nearly the entire film. The way when he talks to characters, he keeps talking in these weird elliptical circles. So he keeps sort of repeating himself. So he'll say a sentence, then he'll come back to the beginning of the sentence and then stop. And he sort of keeps doing that with everybody. And these sort of like, within his family unit, he has these weird expressions of concern that you can tell he just doesn't feel.
Yeah,
he's saying to the characters, because, you know, I care about you. That one of the other brothers is quite clearly codified, I think, as being gay, or certainly not being as sort of Australian macho as the other brothers. And there's a terrifying conversation where he's talking to this guy Mendelssohn, and he's just sort of going, because, yeah, you know, if you are gay, it's okay. I just don't want you living a lie, mate. Do you know what I mean? And he just keeps going back to it. It's so intense.
He's doing it because he's bored and he's just playing. It's called Animal Kingdom, and it very subtly just sort of the interactions are about how animal we are in our kind of reactions and our interactions with people. And that bit is like a real bit. I mean, he's talking to his brother, and this is, you know, the whole film. I guess the other thing the reason it can be kind of compared to Goodfellas is because, like Goodfellas, it's about how there's this incredibly intense bond, this familial bond in this kind of crime family, and yet they all sell each other out at the fucking drop of a hat, because obviously they're all just complete snakes. And in this, there's something like the self-contained defensiveness of the family unit. These brothers and this grandmother at the matriarch at the head of their family and all this stuff, and yet they're all fucking ready to kill each other actually at the drop of a hat. And so there's that scene is really chilling, because he's talking to his brother and they're kind of supposed to be kind of grieving together about something that's happened, and actually he's just using it as a chance to sort of goad him into a fight, really. That's what he's doing. So he can kind of beat him up, really. That's kind of, maybe even worse. Who knows what he's trying to do? But it's really the way that the younger brother is just kind of essentially just acting like an omega and just trying to sort of go, look, just don't. Just fuck off. But, you know, essentially trying his hardest not to, like, this nasty psychopathic older brother who's just, like you say, just expressing how much he's worried about him and how he just wants him to be himself. And he's not. He's basically being homophobic and trying to goad him into a fight. And that's what he's actually doing. Mm. And it's a genuine, like, I watched that scene. I was like on the edge of my seat. This was a film where I expected violence to happen way more than it does.
Oh, God. It's been really funny. I've been watching The Sopranos again recently, because we're in lockdown and now is obviously the time to rewatch The Sopranos, isn't it? And it's really interesting to me, sort of watching Animal Kingdom and while I'm rewatching The Sopranos and going, like, The Sopranos, despite its reputation as being a subversion of the sort of gangster, the sort of the classic Goodfellas gangster film style idiom, actually relies an awful lot on gangster traditions. There are lots of like punishment beatings and money extractions and people getting run over and people having car doors. There is none of that in this film. There is none of it at all, but the threat of it is constantly there. Like, every time one of the brothers comes home and they give the sort of matriarch character the sort of, you know, that amusingly coloured Australian money that they always have, they give the matriarch character that, you are left under no impression as to the kind of thing that they have done. Even if they are all some kind of mating and joking around with each other, you're never under any kind of like illusions about what they have done to get that. But it never shows it. And I think that's really clever. The only violence it shows is of the police against them.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the only violence you get. And it always involves guns. And it's just like one shot and it's done.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's out of the blue. Yeah. And that's the thing. You've got these kind of the cops and robbers, you know, that against each other. And you don't go into much, you know. It's a film that likes to kind of keep its hands reasonably close to its chest. It doesn't give you a huge amount of detail, but you understand really clearly that, you know, the cops are deeply corrupt because they just straight up murder one of the brothers for no fucking reason. And it's like, oh, okay. So these guys are, you know, but you understand that it's like operating on this kind of tit for tat brutal level.
It's a gang war movie.
Yeah.
It's a movie and about two.
One
movie
is the cops.
Yeah.
They, you know, and, you know, Guy Pearce's character, who plays the good cop in it, his motivations are never clear.
Yeah.
He seems to be acting as a good cop, but actually what he's doing is using this young guy to essentially destroy the family. And he's, in some ways, he's as cold and calculating as the grandmother. And we need to get to her because she is astonishing.
She's so...
Jackie Weaver is... So what I loved about her is you understood from the outset that in order to be this family of fucking, like you said, this low-level, I don't know, small-town psychos, basically, that she, in order to be like the head of that family, we know there's some steel there, but for 95% of the film, she is a grandma. She's a nice grandma. And they're all nice to grandma, aren't they? Yeah, you say, as you say, they come in, they give her some money, they give her cuddles. She's always giving out hugs.
She kisses everyone straight on the lips, doesn't she?
Really,
unsettling.
Really, and for a bit too long.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got this real sort of, and this is another thing that, you know, we'll get to in the next film after this, but this kind of men without women thing where there's only one woman in this family, really. And it's this woman. And there's this feeling of like that she's kind of holding on to everyone. You know, she's not letting them go. So those kisses on the lips are very long and lingering, you know, but it's all just suggestive. But for 95% of the film, she is just a kind of warm, grandmotherly presence until she isn't. And then she's fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
She never does anything physically. She doesn't lose her cool. She doesn't like explode with rage. But there is a change that happens when she's talking to someone at one point where like the level of her coldness and her sort of reptilian-like kind of survival instinct is just fucking amazing. It's a genuinely like, she's genuinely scary again in a way that is, you know, she's a kind of lovely, cuddly little old lady, you know?
And she'd throw you under a bus.
Absolutely, and she does.
I mean, I would recommend it to any fan of the genre, definitely. I mean, it's a fantastic crime film. I did have a bit of a problem with the sort of, the overall affectlessness of your main character, the Josh character, who is your sort of eyes and ears into this world. He's so sort of numb. And, you know, he has good reason to be. It's no spoiler to say that the film starts with him sitting next to his OD'd mum's corpse. You know what I mean? He's obviously had a shitty life. But it's quite difficult to sort of, to feel a sort of real connection to the movie if your eyes and ears into it is so kind of like, you know, at points he just, he doesn't flinch when he has guns pointed at him at points. And he sort of becomes a little bit of a, he starts feeling almost a bit more like a storytelling device than an actual character.
I know what you mean. I think I think on one level it's a tremendous performance. I think his blankness and his sort of sullen teenage blankness works really well because you understand that it's a kind of protective shell that it begins to whittle down when he spends some time with his girlfriend's family, who are just a normal family, and the dad is just a normal dad, and you begin to see him thawing. But it's not, I liked the fact that it wasn't a cliched kind of like, oh look, he's just, you know, he's realized what love is. It's more like he's just kind of going, oh, I see, this is like what it's like when your family isn't like an immediate threat to you. So this is what it's like when you don't have to be scared of your family all the time. I think it's good that, you know, it's so unsentimental that it doesn't go down there, but I know what you mean. There is it's a low-key film in a lot of ways, that there was a certain point that I was about three quarters of the way through and I was like, when's this film going to get going? And then I was like, oh, it is going. I see, this is kind of, you know, because I think I was expecting a kind of more pyrokinetic, vicious kind of movie, and it, in a way, like, it's to its credit that it isn't that, but there was something a little bit staid about it, perhaps too much so at certain points, you know.
It does kind of lose momentum towards the end when the sort of when the wider ramifications of how this family is operated and how they're sort of like on-off combat with the police start actually playing out on a more kind of, without wishing to give spoilers away, because you should go into this one as blind as possible, on a more sort of political sphere, shall we say,
yeah,
it loses a bit of its tension. And actually that there is a point, a sort of at the end of the second act, where you're like, the film could actually just finish here and it would be fantastic. And it would be really good. And then it does kind of keep going. And it picks up almost immediately afterwards, but there is this quick lull. And you do suddenly realise it's like, oh yeah, virtually nothing has happened in this film. And like you say, that's to its credit. You know, it works almost as an antidote to the usual gangster movie. I mean, it's so relentlessly unglamorous. Yeah. You know what I mean? But, I mean, for a start, no offence anybody, but the Australian accent will deglamorise absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. It's like the Brummy accent, you know, it'll just it's just a flat line in terms of like glamour. I think it was just that thing of you know, that unglamorousness is an antidote, is a tonic. Because, you know, I was really surprised as well that this was a first film, because what we were talking about with Ari Aster, you know, the kind of obviousness that after a second watch, we're like, oh, I see, yeah. I mean, this is, as a debut goes, the kind of control and confidence with which it is delivered, that kind of low-key, naturalistic way, it's really astonishing, actually. Like, yeah. I assumed it was a kind of seasoned director. As a debut goes, it's so lacking in pyrotechnics and showiness and kind of like, here's my, what can I do with this camera? And it's like, it's much closer to like a Ken Loach film or something.
Yes, yeah. Did you see him?
Or Alan Clark, maybe, in his more sort of, you know.
Elephant is actually a really good call with this movie. It had an atmosphere that there were sequences in this that reminded me of some of the more drawn out elements in Elephant.
The whole of Elephant.
Yeah, the whole of Elephant, basically.
What a film. We need to talk about that.
We'll definitely talk about Alan Clark at some point.
Yeah.
Did you see David Michaud's film after this? Did you see The Rover?
I don't think I did.
So it's a sort of like Mad Max style just after the apocalypse film with Guy Pearce and Robert Pattinson. Where someone steals Guy Pearce's car. Have you not seen this?
No.
It's really good. I think you'd quite
like it. Where you started with that sentence and where you ended, it was like an entire journey for me of like, I know I want to see this so much.
it's really good. It's a similarly sort of understated style. I mean, you know, when I say Mad Max, we're not talking Fury Road, we're talking the first Mad Max here, you know.
Yeah.
There's no souped up people in leather cob pieces in this one.
Yeah.
But it's a very good sort of understated thing. And basically the instigating thing is it's called The Rover because someone just steals Guy Pearce's car.
Uh-huh.
And he's not fucking having it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So he goes on this post-apocalyptic trek to get his Rover back. And it's, yeah, again, similarly unsentimental, unflashy, suggests its brutality more than showing it, and is a depiction of a world where sort of hope has basically just fallen apart. There just isn't
it.
And that was the other thing that I really liked about Animal Kingdom, was the suggestion that within this house, there was literally all they could do, as you say, the title's Animal Kingdom, all they can do is survive. That's literally the only thing that they can do, that they can hope to do, is just survive for as long as humanly possible. And the Guy Pearce character, who is, as you say, he's the sort of, I mean, he's almost more the audience surrogate than the sort of main character up to a point.
Until you begin to realise that, you know, when you actually start to unpack his actions, and you go,
he's almost the sort of audience surrogate, and he talks to her at some, the Jackie Weaver character at the end, and he is just like, they basically have that conversation. It's like, all you're doing is basically fucking surviving. That is literally what you're doing. But also I mean, like they really go out of their way to uglify Guy Pearce in this film, don't they? And it is basically
got bad hair,
yeah,
moustache.
He's got a Hitler pencil moustache.
Yeah, he looks like the manager of a Rumbelows or something. And this is Guy Pearce as well, you know.
He's the devastatingly handsome manager of a Rumbelows.
With secret giant arms underneath that short sleeve shirt.
And actually another thing, it would be very low of me if I didn't point this out. How much Ben Mendelsohn looks like Jimmy Percy, the lead singer from Shabba 69. At the end, they put him in the stripy shirt, which is obviously the Jimmy Percy trademark. And I was like, that's got to be fucking deliberate.
Andy Serkis played Ian Dury, and it was like, well, this is obvious. I mean, he literally looks so like him. And it was, I mean, this is it. It's like, we need the Jimmy Percy story with Ben Mendelsohn.
I would watch the shit out of that. Can you imagine? That'd be amazing.
Film like an Alan Clark film as well. Loads of bike chain whippings.
I have expressed this before. If there was to be one punk biopic that I would watch, it would be a Sham 69 biopic. Yeah. I'd be more interested than any of the other bands.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Now, I mean, this was great, actually, because when we were kind of picking out the films, you know, this was a bit of an outlier in that, like you said, we don't normally do crime films. And if we do, they might tend towards the more outre sort of weird sort of element. And actually, this was, you know, naturalistic, low key. But I mean, I was gripped, utterly gripped from frame one. I think it's an astonishingly tense film for a film that doesn't have what you expect. You know, there's some nasty shit in it, don't get me wrong, but I was kind of thinking, oh, this is going to be the kind of film where I watch someone get their like head stomped or for like 10 minutes or something. It's going to be really, you know, nasty. And it's like, no, the nastiness is much more devastating, actually, when it kind of comes, you know. And it is like Goodfellas, it plays on this idea that there is nothing, this kind of intensely close bond that you have, this family has, that, you know, no one will fuck with them, and if you fuck with one of them, you fuck with all of them. And it's like all this stuff. And yet at the end of the day, it's also just this complete, you know, it's not a hug, it's a fist that's got you in its, you know, clenched. That is played out really well, like the sense of unease that these family scenes play out with is just really like harrowing, you know.
I think it's just, again, one of those things where it's like, I think I'm sort of gravitating more as I get a little bit older towards the sort of, you know, the subgenre that I'm going to call crappy crime. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's the low stakes stuff that I actually find a bit more compelling. It's like when you read the Derek Raymond novels, the London-based Derek Raymond novels, right? 70s and 80s. It's like that. It's always grubby and small and a bit shit, and it sort of makes the stakes more relatable, sure. And but when you suck the glamour out of it, what you're left with is this is the kind of the genuinely unappealing nature of a lot of what happens here, a lot of what this stuff is. And I find that a lot more compelling than I do another, you know, Scorsese riff, much like Scorsese's film. You know, that to me seems to me to be, and also to be a little bit more sort of appropriate to the kind of films that feel appropriate in the situation that we're in sort of politically now.
We're heading towards, you know, something which would probably be more akin to the Great Depression than anything else. So these kind of, you know, desperate times and things. You know, I think the Safdie brothers are making those kind of films. You know, I think Good Times and Uncut Gems. Uncut Gems is different. Uncut Gems deals with a different tier of criminality, and that's what's so fascinating. But, you know, Good Time is like Robert Pattinson as, you know, the ultimate bottom feeding shark-like kind of, if you stop moving, you're dead kind of character. But he's just, it's just all so small time. It's all so small time, but it's so compelling, you know.
Well, they're hucksters, aren't they? They have to be hucksters to survive. And the sort of the character of the huckster for me is much more interesting than the character of, like, you know, for example, the made man, or the soldier. Whether this idea of the kind of like the essential kind of like two-facedness that it takes to operate in that world is really compelling, and the sort of identity that you need to have, like you say, within a family, within your job, within your sort of, you know, within the crimes that you commit, the sort of sense of kind of like loose identity that you have to be able to sort of slip and move within the cracks in that system. That's something that I think is just very cinematic. It just lends itself to really good storytelling. And I think Animal Kingdom just really nailed that for me.
Absolutely, yeah. And we couldn't go from one extreme more to the other, from a low-key, naturalistic, family-based crime drama than to our final film this episode, which is...
Our final film, Dan, is The Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Years ago, audiences across America were horrified by the savagery of a faceless killer. In the wake of this bizarre rampage, he vanished. Now, after more than a decade of silence, he has come out of hiding. Chainsaw Massacre 2, The Buzz is back, directed by Tobe Hooper.
Oh, fuck me, what a film.
Yeah, so partly because I'm genuinely quite surprised about this, this is the first time you have ever seen this. So, what did you think?
Well, my word, what is there to say about this movie? Like, now, obviously... This is the thing. This is another edition of Matt Colgate admits to massive gap in knowledge, isn't it? Basically, I should have seen this film ages ago. It's got me written all over it. It's a canon movie, for fuck's sake. You know, it's a widely regarded as batshit sequel to a classic first film, which no one quite knows what to do with. To this day, no one quite knows what to do with The Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. And it is fucking nuts, man. This film is nuts. It's so entertaining. And like, I can't think of another film that's quite like it. I can think of puppet shows I've seen that are quite like it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, because they got Tobe Hooper back, didn't they? And I imagine they'd probably been trying to get him to make a second Texas Chainsaw Massacre for quite a long time. Because this is 1986, so this is what, how many years afterwards?
Well, I think the original is 74.
That's 12 years. That's a long time, and obviously, dear Toby he'd made a lot of stuff in the interim, and he'd done all kinds of different stuff. He's a fascinating director. Getting started on Life Force, you will be here all night. You know, the vibe of this film is that they were so desperate to get Tobe Hooper to do it, they just said, you can do anything. And he just went, anything? And then did it. Because this film really goes at it. It stylistically, it's amazing. This film looks incredible.
Really does, and very influential as well. Mm. There's a big argument for big chunks of Tarantino's you know, he obviously has got his go-tos like De Palma, but I think it's fair to say, you know, big chunks of like Kill Bill are deeply influenced by Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. The palette is, that's the thing I really felt actually is...
Dude, I would say all of From Dusk Till Dawn is Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Entirely. Like these kind of like huge... caves set. I mean, the whole thing is on sound stages and sets. It's so fucking weird. I mean, this is Tobe Hooper has been kind of perfecting this thing since, you know, the real outlier is Texas Chainsaw Massacre in Tobe Hooper's career. He is actually someone who loves having his toys to play with, and he loves creating these worlds. So the film I think he does after, now he might, Funhouse might come after it, but there's a film called Eaten Alive. Have you seen Eaten Alive?
I haven't. I've heard really good things.
Yeah. Well, it suffers from a lot of what Toby Hooper's films suffer from. They can be quite tedious because he is essentially a guy who smokes too much weed. So he is all about the vibe. He is all about the aesthetic. He is trying to recreate the EC horror comics of his youth that he loved and the lurid sci-fi of his youth that he loved. He just, again and again, so Eaten Alive is about a crazy man who has a fucking pet alligator who runs some sort of bordello slash boarding house thing and just kills his guests. It's kind of Sweeney Todd-ish.
It's not a sustainable business system, that, is it?
No, but it, you know, it's a film that just literally trades in a bunch of grotesques being awful to each other. And it is a really strange film, but my God, it's got a vibe. And again, all filmed on a soundstage. It's all set bound. So it's got this really like rich kind of pulpy feeling. And that's like the 70s, and it costs probably about a tenth of what Texas Chainsaw. But then you've got Life Force, Invaders from Mars, all of them like incredible looking, almost all of them set on stages, you know, sound stages, set based stuff, weird puppet shows. Puppet shows is a really good shout, you know, that's what it's like. He's a real odd guy. Like, what the fuck is he trying to do? This is a film that genuinely, in the course of watching it, you find yourself scratching your head so many times as to what he thought was going to be the reception to it, you know.
Like... Well, do you know what, Dan? I'm going to leave this one up to you. Could you please explain the plot of Texas Chainsaw Massacre to us?
So, okay, so
I'm just going to sit back and I'm going to watch you do this.
So one of the things that I particularly like about this is it starts with a nod to its own first Texas Chainsaw, which is kind of starts with almost like realistic, like, you know, this is basically a true story. And, you know,
it starts with a scroll, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And the scroll's going too fast for the bloke to read it. You can hear him speeding up at the end as it gets closer to the top.
So it kind of, from the start, it apes the first film. In the first film, you get this kind of like this voiceover saying, you know, this thing happened. And then it cuts into kind of some reports, you know, overhearing kind of footage from, you know, police radio and reports. And then you kind of pan into this like grotesque kind of weird bone sculpture on a graveyard in Texas. That's the first film. This film, as you say, starts with a Star Wars-like scroll, which basically says, kind of, you know, refers to the first film and says, you know, since that, there have been a number of mysterious chainsaw murders across Texas.
He murdered someone mysteriously with the chainsaw.
Yeah, you know, and also that you wouldn't just be like, I mean, it's just those guys, right? and then you are basically introduced to... Well, I mean, what is it? I mean, you're introduced to some characters. It's Texas Gonzo, right? It's just,
well, the first pure Texas Gonzo. The first character you meet is driving very fast in a car, wearing a pair of those hologram shades with eyes drawn on them, shooting road signs with a revolver, and it becomes clear during the course of the action that this gentleman's name is Rick the Prick.
So in the 80s
the thing is, it's hard to say that we're not in Kansas anymore when we actually clearly are in Kansas.
So in the one of my favorite tropes of the 80s is the hateful prick punk characters, right? You know, the kind of sneering kind of
you guys mean that dude,
assholes, the guys who are like, they're like nihilistic, they're like something out of a Devo video or something. They're like these horrible, like nihilistic, sneering, sniveling, hateful pricks that sometimes in the 80s were the heroes of the film.
Often.
But largely they tended to be the cannon fodder of exploitation films. And this has the very pinnacle of the prick characters. These two guys who we're introduced to, who are like apparently notionally on their way to some sort of like hootenanny, some sort of fun time hootenanny.
There's a Beano occurring.
There's a Beano occurring. And they phone into a radio station to basically be pricks. And seemingly this is a radio station where when someone phones in, you can't hang up on them.
Yeah.
So they accidentally, these pricks in their cars accidentally sort of encounter what transpires to be the family from the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So we are introduced, we are immediately given a deeply weird carnivalesque kind of murder sequence at the start. So whereas the first film, everyone always goes, you think you see more than you see, but actually you don't see much actual kind of gore. It's all suggested. In this, you see someone get their head, the top of their head chainsawed off. So these guys are murdered live on air, basically, to a radio station, which links the DJ of said radio station, Stretch, not clear why she's called Stretch,
no.
To the kind of the family, the fucked up family, who basically the entire film is centered around. So there's kind of this weird, but I mean, even just talking it out loud, it's like, yeah, that is literally all there is to the film. It's like you're introduced to some pricks, they're murdered, she hears it live on air, so she becomes fascinated by this and is trying to kind of get to the bottom of it, and then somehow she ends up hooking up with Dennis Hopper, who has two chainsaws and a cowboy hat.
Yes, Dennis Hopper in this film. Fuck me. I mean, this is the height of Dennis Hopper, the cocaine years as well, isn't it?
Yeah, this was always when he came back in the 90s, and it was a bit of a kind of like, he's come back from the wilderness, he's in some Tarantino films, he's able to hold conversation again. he's back. People would name check Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 as kind of like his low point, which I think is firstly unfair to Dennis Hopper and to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. But he was deep, deep in the cocaine psychosis, I believe, when he was filming this. And my God, does it show.
Yes. Do you know one thing that doesn't show in this film, though, Dan? Dennis Hopper's gut. Dennis Hopper is wearing a truss in this film. That suit is way too small for a man that size.
Tiny.
He is wearing a fucking... You can tell he's wearing a girdle. He does not bend over once in this movie. No. He constantly has a straight back. And his head, it looks like it's being pushed out of a tube of toothpaste. It's like this... So he's got this tiny, it's like someone's drawn Dennis Hopper's head on a matchstick body in a nudie suit.
I'm like, has Dennis Hopper's head always been that big? And now you say it, that makes sense.
Yeah, no, he's basically just like, I'm not letting them see my cocaine gut. And they just thrust him up, pushed him into this suit. And his head, it looks like, it actually, weirdly enough, as a callback to another Toby Hooper film, it looks a bit like the Alien Queen from Invaders from Mars. It's just got this giant dome on top of this tiny matchstick body. So and he doesn't. You don't see him bend over once. And clearly, every time he does, it's causing him physical agony.
So one of the things we should say that Dennis Hopper plays, I think he's the brother of Franklin and what's the name of the girl? Anyway, the brother and sister in the original Dennis Hopper, is he their brother or their dad? I wasn't sure.
I think he's meant to be the brother, but I reckon I bet you anything he was written as the dad. He was like, no, too old, I'm the brother.
Yeah. I think you're right, because it doesn't quite track that he's like, you know, the other brother who wasn't there. Anyway, so he's got a you know, dog in the game. You know, he's very invested in this crime. And he plays a police kind of detective who's come from, you know, out of state, basically. And he's called Lefty. Again, we don't know why.
Yeah.
Got Stretch and Lefty and LG, who's the guy who works at the radio station. And one of the things I quite like is the way that we never get any suggestion of why that guy's called Lefty, she's called Stretch. So, yeah, you've got essentially what you've got with Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is Toby Hooper upending every single thing that people liked about the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And, you know, that's a film that gets name checked so hard and so often. that it, you know, it feels irrelevant to talk about what's good about it, really, because it's you know, you can go anywhere and find out what's good about that film, and you can just experience it for yourself.
Yes.
It is a singular, intense, and, you know, utterly unique experience. And the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is completely different. There are similarities. Routinely, you know, people sort of just play up the differences in that it is unsubtle. You know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a stripped down film with almost no dialogue, really. You know, that just kind of leans hard into a kind of brutalist realism for such a kind of extraordinary exploitative film. And this is a complete, you know, fantasia, a cartoon with endless reams of exposition.
Yeah.
And just, you know, completely unbelievable cartoon character sort of performances. Like, it is, the whole film is dialed up to about 15, really.
Mm.
And yet it is quite similar in that it is relentlessly committed to making you feel nauseous and sort of unsettled. It really is.
The interesting thing that, you know, that you said earlier about Tobe Hooper was that he's a vibes master, you know, and the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre has a very definite vibe.
Yeah.
It's the vibe he could afford. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's totally, that's what gives it its grungy aesthetics, because it costs 20 fucking p in a packet of crisps. That's how much it costs. You know, that's why it's like that. And he works with what he's got. Yeah. This film has a very, very, excuse me, definite vibe. It's a real vibes film, this one.
Yeah.
That vibe, like the most telling thing about this film, and the thing, as soon as I clocked this, I was like, okay, I know where we are. Like, one of the first records that you hear Stretch playing on air is The Cramps.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is the filmic equivalent of a Cramps album. It is that grotesque, broken Americana. You know what I mean? It's a psychobilly film.
Yeah, it is. It is 100% a psychobilly.
Hicks on acid gone mad. Do you know what I mean? It's like, do you know that?
Whole Surfers, isn't it? It's like,
yeah. Or I was going to say, have you ever heard that guy, Hazel Adkins?
No.
You know, Hazel Adkins is this famous, like, hillbilly dude that used to record records on a sort of a two-track, and they're all about, like, beheading his wife and stuff like that. And it's just him stomping on a fucking carcass and playing an acoustic guitar and yelping. It's really good. You'd like it. But, like, if that's Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1, The Cramps is Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. It's like a hi-fi, full kind of, like, full stereo production version of the first film. And you're right, they are similar. And I think if he had the budget, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1 would have been much more similar to this film.
Yeah, I think that where he wants to land is probably, looking overall at his career, is more to the second one than the first one.
Yeah.
I think he is, what his power is that he's, as a filmmaker, he's got, and this is why I think, you know, he's such a stoner, and, you know, you read interviews and they get that feeling, but he's got that kind of stoner attention to detail and attention to the feeling and the texture, but he's losing any sense of momentum and kineticism. That is my big complaint with almost all of his films, apart from the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which just has a relentless energy and is 74 minutes long or whatever.
Yeah.
It is. It's so short that is that he, you know, for such a gonzo weird film, the second Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it has periods of just maddening boredom, actually. I mean, I think you know, experiencing it the first time around, sure, it has a kind of like, what the fuckness that kind of keeps you powered along, but it, like, scenes play out it just a really sort of like strange length, and it's, the Grand Guignol is like a part of that, but it's a bit like watching a Herschel Gordon Lewis film in the way that you're kind of like, this is so horrible. It's also quite boring, and like, boring is such a weird word to use when I'm talking about this film, because it is not boring, but there is just, it cannot quite survive on just its vibe alone. It can get fucking close because it's got such a sort of solid, you can almost taste it, the vibe of this film, but it is still, you know, nearly 100 minutes long. And there are sequences that just are go on too long. And there's just a pitch that it hits for the last kind of, I don't know, 40 minutes of the film that it never comes back. It never comes down from it, never deviates. And it just becomes a bit exhausting, actually. It becomes a bit like, you know, it's like when Sam Raimi's on a bit, you know, he can do that too a bit. You know, when he's just in love with his kind of what he's doing, he's sort of sometimes a bit like, okay, just breathe, stop, breathe. You know, Raimi's better than Hooper in terms of he understands the mechanics of an actual film in a better way, I think. I think Hooper just gets lost in the moment, really, and he's just like enjoying it all too much to just kind of, yeah.
I love that. Do you know what I mean? I love seeing someone get lost in that moment.
Yeah.
And I know the scenes you mean, like the scene in the hotel room with Dennis Hopper is fucking interminable. And actually nothing comes out of that scene at all. It makes no difference to the film on any level, apart from the fact that Toby Hooper gets to show some frat boys for some reason.
Yeah.
Just really enjoys it. He's actually in that scene as well.
He is, yeah.
And he wrote the fucking music to this film too.
Which is, the music is kind of great, right?
Yeah, it's really good. It's really good. And the soundtrack choices are fucking fantastic. But another thing is a sort of indicator of where this film is coming from. You know, the sports broadcaster that you hear at one point, that's Kinky Friedman.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's Kinky Friedman. And like, this is very much, so, which, you know, the hiring of Kinky Friedman makes me realise that Toby Hooper knows exactly where he's playing here. Do you know what I mean? He knows what he's doing. And he's familiar with this sort of this post-punk rockabilly aesthetic. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. He knows what this stuff is. I think, you know, he probably went to punk clubs. He probably saw the Blasters. Do you know what I mean? Like, he was probably hanging out in that scene, smoking pot and watching these sort of... Like,
I think so, yeah. I
mean, and these sort of weird, bequiffed psychobilly bands. And it's almost like... The thing that I liked about it was that it almost played as an homage to that kind of stripped-down, weird rock and roll. I mean, it encapsulates, the only thing that it doesn't do that encapsulates that is it's not short.
Yeah.
The thing is, I mean, it all bets are off with this film by the time it gets to the final third, where it basically literally all the entire action relocates to a funhouse, which the family have turned into a giant murder funhouse.
Yeah, they're sort of where they're notionally, because it's based around the fact that the family is making like the best chili in Texas.
Yes, they keep winning chili competitions.
So, you know, that's the factory, which is great. Because I just love the idea that, you know, there's also in this kind of ridiculous carnival-esque sort of funhouse, grotesque kind of Boschian horror show, there is also a packing plant where they're like putting everything into like nice packages and shipping it out. Anyway,
say what you like about those boys, Dan. They all worked hard.
Exactly.
It's an American success story.
Well, yeah, and we'll come to the sort of the Reagan sort of satire and how much that is or isn't, you know, present really, I guess. But what I just wanted to say is that the end with it, where it just, you know, this incredible sort of underground weird set where people are just charging around chasing each other, it just reminded me of like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. It really had the same feeling. It was like we are firmly in the realms of like kind of pulp fantasy at this moment. And actually Toby Hooper and George Lucas and Steven Spielberg and Brian De Palma, they're all from the same generation. They're all from that. They all grew up reading pulp stuff and loving pulp stuff. And Hooper is the one who really just is like locked into that groove, you know, and everything he does. So, you know, if you compare this film to Life Force is like 1985. This is 1986. Life Force looks like it was made in the 70s in Britain.
Yeah.
And that is not by accident. He knows the vibe he wants to go for. He's doing quite a mass riff with an endlessly naked sexy alien chick
and a lead actor with absolutely no charisma whatsoever.
One of the biggest dicks in history.
Oh my god, that film again. Another night we will talk about we'll talk about Life.
So that, I mean, that leads me on to a thing, right? So he, you know, Toby Hooper and women, okay.
Okay, yeah.
Right, because on one level, you've got large chunks of his most famous films involve women being terrorized for a long time.
Mm.
You know, Marilyn Chambers in is it Marilyn Chambers? I think that's
yeah.
In the first film, literally screams for the final three quarters of that film, and looks genuinely terrified whilst doing so. Caroline Williamson, who plays Stretch in this film, is also similarly sort of terrorized and to some grotesque lengths. But I feel like he is deeply invested in her in a way that I don't think you get the same vibe from in the first one. In the first one, she's just a kind of hippie girl who ends up in hell and somehow survives.
Yeah.
Whereas
he thinks Stretch
feels a bit more like you're kind of rooting for her a bit more, aren't you? She's kind of plucky and ballsy. And it's not like just, I think just kind of going, oh, this is just misogyny. I don't think that's kind of right. It doesn't feel like that, this film. It feels like the men are the men without women are the problem. You know, this is what happens when men don't have women in their lives. They turn into like this. There's no mums and there's no girlfriends and no sisters. You get this fucking cannibal family. You know,
Dan, they set up and all work a successful business. Okay, at the end of the day, that's what you have to bear in mind. They're an American success story. But no, you're absolutely right. He obviously is like deeply in love with Stretch. He thinks Stretch is really fucking cool. And she is.
And she is cool.
Yeah, she's well cool. She's a radio DJ. She plays really cool punk and new wave music. She doesn't take any shit from her slack-jawed producer. She's a cool chick. Do you know what I mean? Like I kind of fell a bit in love with Caroline Williams in this film. I thought she was brilliant.
And again, she meets the tone of this film and goes, I know what you need me to do. You need me to dial it right up, right? And she does. And, you know, her screams. But I think the difference between, say, like Marilyn Chambers' performance in the first one is that feels like you could almost be watching a documentary of someone who is genuinely being terrorized.
Oh, and she was, yeah, you know.
In line with the kind of more self-aware, cartoony nature of this one, I think Caroline Williams' performance is really like, she knows that when you scream, you got to give it like your all, you know, and she really does. She's really like going for it. And it's what stops it feeling kind of, I don't know, like pornographically exploitative when you're just watching someone kind of being terrorized endlessly.
But the interesting thing about her is that she's not a final girl. She's a heroine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, she at the end, she takes on a member of the family with a chainsaw and triumphs and she fucking beats it, you know. Obviously, Dennis Hopper arrives on the scene and basically makes everything worse.
What I like about him is he turns up and starts trying to chainsaw everything apart. But like he's like, I'm going to bring it all down. But he just starts like one timber at a time at the front of the building. And it's like, I'm not sure that's the way to do this.
I think what you'll find, Dan, is that as he wasn't wearing a hard hat, that was actually the most responsible way to bring it all down. You know, it was just like one support structure at a time. So yeah, it's like you've got this entire last scene of like, you know, poor Caroline Williams screaming and trying to escape, and then it just keeps coming, going back to Dennis Hopper doing some woodwork and yelling.
And also, there's a one of the bizarre things is for a film that seems to have an infinite budget, in some ways, three of the main characters die off camera with an off camera explosion, which is really weird. you know, there's this grenade that is kind of like introduced in a pure kind of Hitchcockian kind of like, here's the grenade, you don't see Leatherface, Dennis Hopper, or the older brother, I can't remember, you know, the kind of the guy who really is fucking,
he's going really
overacting. I mean, he's just insane.
I love him in this film. The bit where he's going through the records in the record station, he pulls the record and just goes, "Humble Pie."
no, not Bill Moseley as Chop Top. No, no, that's you, right? That guy is you. I mean, he is you.
Thanks, Sam.
No, I mean the bit where he's like you say, he's going through the records. I was just like, that is made for for Matt Colgate that moment.
There was a chunky 70s mod rock reference. I wasn't not going to spot that.
Everything about him just was like, he's designed to please you, basically. the older brother, you know, the kind
oh,
of...
Oh, yeah.
The respectable face of the Chili Company. Yeah, him, Leatherface, and Dennis Hopper all die off screen in an explosion. And it's
Jim Seidel, who plays Cook.
That's it. Yeah.
Who at the end of that film starts bearing a really remarkable resemblance to Keith Floyd.
He's like Richard Nixon crossed with Keith Floyd. Yeah.
It's this terrifying kind of like, he's absolutely brilliant. I love him. His performance at the Chili Cook-Off alone is, you know, enough to battery power most films for a 90-minute duration.
I mean, this is an extraordinary film. I mean, what I think is crazy as well is that, you know, when boring horror fans wang on about, you know, the various franchises, you know, yeah, which one do you like? Do you like Halloween or do you like Friday the 13th or do you like Texas Chainsaw? I'm like, I mean, you can't compare the Texas Chainsaw films to any other thing. They don't belong in the same conversation as the Friday the 13th film. They don't belong in the same conversation as Halloween. You know, Halloween... even at their most extraordinary, the Halloween films are still largely, you know, a guy goes around and kills a bunch of teenagers. These films are just certainly I don't think I've seen Leatherface, the third one, or Return of the Texas Chainsaw, or, you know, the Next Generation one or whatever it was. But, you know, the Toby Hooper films are just, you know, they're something else. They are, like you were saying with Ari Aster, you know, being closer to someone like Argento, like Hooper is his own thing, you know. Mm-hmm. there is no one else who quite captures the insanity like Hooper does, and he is a deeply influential director on a bunch of kind of, you know, the kind of new grindhouse stuff, you know. Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino have definitely sat around and talked about Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 at length. It's a kind of influential film that has zero respect, you know. No one likes it, really. But, you know, there's clearly a huge school that just, like, took it and went, this is fucking amazing, you know.
It was interesting seeing this one and being like, it was the fact, like, you know, I'd seen Life Force, obviously, I'm a massive fan of.
Yeah.
And
Invaders
from Mars I like a lot, but it's kind of tempered by the fact the original is one of my favorite films of all time. So it's like,
again, Invaders from Mars is one of those, you know, Hooper has a real power of making like films that should be kind of short and snappy feel way longer than they are. And yeah, I don't know whether they are, because they're canon films, for fuck's sake. But yeah, Invaders from Mars is like weirdly tedious, even though it's kind of got moments of genuine like beauty.
I still love it, but like I say, like the 50s original is like easily, it's in my top 10 films of all time.
Yeah,
I worship that film. But watching TCM2 was sort of the first time, and I should have probably put this together, was like, he's a trash maven. He is one of the first examples. He's almost like, I mean, so we're talking 1986, so we're talking like sort of basically right on the cusp of kind of like postmodernism coming out of intellectual discourse and just beginning to sort of infiltrate the mainstream. But he's way ahead of someone like Tarantino, way ahead. He's way ahead of a lot of these people. And he's one of the first people to go, there is real beauty in this trash, in the trash. Mm. You know what I mean? There's the Philip K. Dick, you know, everything good originates in the trash stratum. You know, and Toby Hooper is one of the first directors to kind of postmodernically pick this stuff out of the gutter and go, this is exciting. Well, you know, this stuff moves, you know.
I think it's interesting that, like, he routinely is talked about as, like, you know, the career that could have been, you know.
Bullshit.
Like,
fucking bullshit.
And it's like, I think he had the career he wanted, you know. I think I'm sure there were times when later on when he was kind of like, oh, yeah, I wouldn't mind a bit more money. But the Canon, you know, he was given like a, you know, 3-picture deal with Canon, basically said, do whatever the fuck you want.
And look what he did. He made three astonishingly audacious, failed, But I mean, they're so close to being masterpieces. As much, I mean, Life Force is achieves a particular kind of greatness.
And
I would argue that Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 achieves genuine greatness. I think it is a phenomenal. It is a pinnacle. Again, with bands like the Cramps, with that sort of first generation of people that started looking back at the sort of the curdled remains of the 1950s and going, this shit is worth something. This is really worth something. And he's one of the first people to do that. And I'm sorry, as far as I'm concerned, that just makes him fucking ahead of his time.
Oh,
I mean,
for sure.
He is a postmodern director before postmodernism started infiltrating the mainstream. He's way ahead of Miramax. He's before Tarantino. He's way ahead of his time.
Yeah, and it's interesting if you read the interviews with him. You know, he's a really erudite, smart guy, and you know, effortlessly sort of referencing, you know, a great deal of stuff outside of movies. He's not just some sort of, you know, tired, weird guy who's obsessed with the stuff that he liked when he's 12. I mean, he was still very interested in the world around him. And every account you hear about people who work with him, like later in life, just say, you know, a genuinely sweet guy. Just a big stoner as well, which I like to say, it was a real revelation when I was like, oh, these are stoner movies. Of course they are. You know, I don't mean they're for stoners. They're made by a stoner. You know, they're made by someone who is just like locked into, you know, just working out the things that he wants to work out, kind of grooving on the thing he wants to groove on.
Look at the way this film's lit. It's a fucking sensorium. Do you know what I mean? Every frame is so rich.
Yeah,
in colour and movement and imagination, and yeah, he's completely a stone director, but he's got that sort of ability to find the sort of gold in the refuse, and I think that's brilliant. I love people that can do that. I love people who do that in music and in writing and in film. I think that's a really important and impressive thing to be able to do. You know,
well, you know, I jokingly said to you, I think this film invented like Austin, Texas hipsterism, but actually it's more like he kind of just, you know, tuned into a thing that led towards that. You can see that it's obviously always been this kind of a bit like Atlanta, you know. It's like it's obviously just been this place that's just kind of great. It's just that now the rest of the world has noticed. But when you actually look at this film, you look at like the soundtrack, the way everyone's dressed, the way she's dressed, the way she is, you know, it's like this template for fucking coolness. She's just like totally rad, and like you say, she runs this radio station, and then she's got this kind of rockabilly kind of sidekick guy who's kind of, he's like every shit venue technician you've ever worked for. and the palette, the kind of soundtrack, the just the energy of it. But yeah, I mean, it's an astonishing movie, really. What I particularly like is how much money was spent on it. That's just a thing I love. You know, there is no way someone would give anyone that much money
The thing you have to remember about the Cannon Group, Dan, is that at the end of the day, when directors came around to visit them, they all ate out of plastic trays in the office, and all that money that they saved on restaurants, you can see on the screen.
Yeah.
You know, like, any of our listeners who haven't seen Electric Boogaloo, the story of Cannon Films, as soon as you finish listening to this podcast, go and watch it. It is one of the most entertaining documentaries, and you will find out so much about films you didn't even realise were canon that you loved when you were a kid. It's a wonderful doc. And there's a lot in it about Tobe Hooper as well. He's interviewed, and there's a lot in it about him.
Yeah, no, he's too often, I think, kind of written about as the person who, you know, had this amazing film and then a weird floundering sporadic career. And actually, I think he's probably the person who sort of always knew what he liked and just wanted to do that and kind of got to do it. And I can't wait until we do our podcast where we talk about The Mangler and Spontaneous Combustion and all those fucking late stage oddities, you know.
Well, let's do a whole 3-hour podcast about Life Force first.
Yeah.
I have a lot to say.
Yeah. But this has been a definite mix, I think. You know, I kind of
pendulum has swung.
The homework for this was a funny one, because I think some of the things that I didn't expect to enjoy, I enjoyed more. Some I enjoyed less. But I really enjoyed the tonal shifts. I like the fact that, you know, that within the framework of a family, you got so much different stuff. And it's such a ripe territory for just kind of really digging into the weirdness. We all have families, and even the most vanilla and mundane and dreary family experience you've had is deeply weird when you start to unpack it. And it's just a real pleasure when filmmakers use that as a way to explore interesting themes and styles and tones and moods, you know.
Yeah, it's been a delight, actually. It was a tough subject to approach in January, particularly after none of us have been allowed to see our families, obviously. But actually, yeah, like this was a nice pill. It made it feel better.
This is basically you and I going, we can't see it. Normally we'd go and see various members of our family, so we just spent time with loads of hideous, fucked up cinematic families instead. It was basically like Christmas, except for I got a lot less gift vouchers.
Okay, well, I think that's about it, isn't it?
I think that's probably a good point to end. Thank you very much again for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this discursive and strange exploration of family.
I'd like to say goodbye to our listening family, Dan, whoever they are.
And we will see you next time on
The Savage Beast.
Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can, and don't have any kids yourself.